We're here today to discuss the question of how can we understand the self-righteousness that pervades our modern culture. And I'm Dr. Peter Saunders. I'm the chief executive of ICMDA, which is the International Christian Medical and Dental Association, which brings together over 80 national associations of Christian doctors and dentists around the world. And I'm the interviewer. And David?
David McElroy. I'm a barrister in London. I'm a visiting professor at the University of Notre Dame.
Well, self-righteousness and modern culture, that's an intriguing title. And David, you're here, you're a practicing barrister in London. You're a visiting professor from the University of Notre Dame in London as well. And your guiding principle, or one of your catchphrases, has been Micah 6:8, act justly, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. And so we really want to engage you on this subject today. Could you tell us a bit about your background and how you got interested in this subject of self-righteousness in modern culture?
I've been interested for a long time in the sort of origin or the underlying assumptions behind ideas. Originally, that was in relation to justice and then in relation to human rights. But increasingly, it's been on questions like critical race theory and wokeism and some of the new movements that we've seen coming through our culture.
The self-righteousness is something we might associate with the Pharisees of the first century or with Christians, hypocrites in the church. It's not something we normally apply to figures in culture. So can you tell us a little bit about the self-righteousness that you're seeing?
Yeah, so I think we're going through a period of profound change. And I think that's exposing self-righteousness on both sides of the debate. So I think for many years, we've had in modernity a period of time where what we might describe as classical liberalism has set the frame for political debate. So you've had left and right, but they sort of agree on a basic set of ground rules that really what we're aiming to do is provide equality of opportunity. And that's given us a sort of liberalist, capitalist, individualist approach to life, where I try and get as much as I can so long as I don't harm other people. That it was in some ways compatible with traditional understandings of family life and could be fitted in with certain understandings of Christian faith, but it also came in a rationalist version. And certainly, so far as questions of ethics were concerned, it was challenged in the 1920s by the Frankfurt School in theory and by the practice of the sort of bright young things in the roaring 20s. And that sort of upper class elite sexual revolution then took over in the 1960s. And that's all about freedom and emancipation, but can be seen in some ways as either amoral or immoral. What's decisively changed, I think, recently is we're seeing this emergence of this new morality. So that new morality is saying, well, it's self-evident that our societies are racist. It's self-evident that capitalism isn't working. It's self-evident that previous generations didn't pay any regard to the climate. It's self-evident that marriage equality, same-sex marriage, is the right thing. It's self-evident that trans people are people as well and have all sorts of rights. And so there's a new list of things where it's taken for granted by those who might describe themselves as woke, that there's something wrong. So we've got sort of progressive Pharisaism.
Yeah.
But that's actually provoking a reaction as well.
So the whole idea of woke, of course, is that people who are woke are awake to what's happening and can see it in a way that others of us who are more blind can't. And we've come perhaps from a more tolerant environment of debate, a kind of live and let die. I may disagree with you, but I'll fight for your right to express it and so on, to something where there's a lot more seeming intolerance of views that don't fit the new paradigm. So what kind of changes are you seeing in the debate when the two sides are engaging?
Well, I mean, you use the term woke, and it's a very interesting term because it does suggest that the other side is blind. And that is because, I think, from the point of view of progressives who would describe themselves in that way, they think that people who hold to a sort of classical liberal understanding of the framework of political debate have missed something. And we have to recognise, I think, that in some ways that's driven out of a profound sense of frustration and intergenerational unfairness. There's a feeling that the baby boomers were able to enjoy the fruits of prosperity, good pensions, nice cars, nice homes, and a combination of rising house prices, climate change, chronically indebted governments mean that you've got a new generation looking at their parents and grandparents and thinking, well, how are we ever going to achieve their standard of living? How did they not realise that their actions were leaving us this kind of world? So that feeling that previous generations have been blind to something then fuels the sense of self-righteousness and those who think that they can see it. I think the other thing as well on that side of the debate is 50 years after civil rights legislation in the US and the UK, they would point to continuing injustices and inequalities between different racial groups and would say, well, again, the equality of opportunity that classical liberals were offering has disappeared. That, I think, provokes a reaction because the baby boomers and others, I think, would say, well, for the whole of our lives, we were told work hard, play by the rules, and then you'll get the rewards. And we did that. And now that it's too late for us to radically change course in terms of how we live, you're telling us that the rules of the game have changed. Why don't you see that that's unfair?
So I guess here we are, two baby boomers, discussing this new debate to which we're blind of aspects of it. Where are the new fault lines here? Is it purely a kind of intergenerational thing, millennials versus baby boomers, or is it more than that? Where are the fault lines?
So I'm just about Gen X. So
okay,
so that's a good thing for a start. There is a definite age profile, but it's not exclusively that. As I indicated, that the roots of a lot of this go back to theories from the 1920s that really took hold in the 60s, and some aspects of it became dominant in many university faculties in the 1990s and 2000s. So there's an intellectual leadership for this from older generations. That I think we see. I think as well what we're getting is polarization, perhaps in a way that we didn't have before. And there are a couple of reasons for that. But at least one of them is that individualism has morphed and developed into expressivism. So the idea is that who I am must automatically be expressed in how I act. And so identity and actions are collapsed. And that means that you find yourself in a situation where everybody is now judged on the basis of everything they've ever done in respect of anything they ever say. And so we find ourselves, when there's so much access to everything I've ever said publicly out there, and we find people sort of policing themselves on social media and in public spaces and lining up and making sure that they're on the right side of the debate on all issues. So that makes it much harder to find middle ground and nuance and people whose views on some things are out of line with other things that people might say in coalition with.
So this plays into virtue signaling, where you're trying to put across a public persona that you think is going to be more acceptable to those who are trailing back through things that you said in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've had examples of sports people losing their place in national sports teams because of something they said 10 years ago. We have, I think, a major controversy in Britain now going on about Winston Churchill, because on the one hand, undeniably great war leader. On the other hand, he was a massive imperialist, and under his rule, between 2 and 4 million people starved to death in Bengal, and his regime didn't do anything about it. We had also the recent example of Jordan Peterson, who was going to come to Cambridge University for a period of study, and then somebody found a photo of him standing next to somebody who was wearing an Islamophobic T-shirt. Now, that was one of 30,000 photos that Jordan Peterson had taken with fans, but the fact that there was one meant that the university withdrew his invitation because they didn't like endorsement by association. The fact he'd never said anything Islamophobic wasn't the point. The fact he was seen to be with someone who was prepared to hold to those views publicly was enough to deplatform him.
Yeah, and deplatform. And is it true that you think, has the debate become more rancorous? So are we seeing more of a kind of dialogue of the deaf where people aren't really listening properly or engaging with what the other side is saying?
I think it's definitely become more rancorous. And I think that one reason that it's become more rancorous is because of this feeling that the other side don't get it. Yeah, you don't realise how hard I worked to get here. Classical liberalism, its champions are the people who've succeeded. So there's a lively industry, and, you know, I made millions through my internet business, you can too. You know, I've built my buy-to-let property empire, you can too. And of course, the implicit message in there is that there is a meritocracy, that there is equality of opportunity. So I deserve to be where I am. And if you haven't made it, well, you deserve to be where you are too, is the implicit message. So you have that on one side, and then on the other side, well, just look at all the numbers. All the statistics show that we don't all start in the same place. Life is like chess. White starts with the advantage, and black is always playing catch-up. How are you not seeing that? And so there is this feeling, you know, you're just blind. It's a really important book written last year by Ian McGilchrist called The Matter with Things. And in that, he, as a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist, says, well, we see the world based on the questions we ask and the things that we're looking for. If you're looking through the stars, you won't see a bird fly past. If you're looking through a microscope, you won't notice the beauty of the totality of a tree. So in some ways, these two sides are living in different worlds, because the bits of reality that they're looking at, the bits of our society they're looking at, are quite different.
So there's a blindness, in a sense, on both sides, you're saying. There are things that each side isn't seeing that the other side thinks they can see, and therefore isn't given credit. So what can you characterise a bit more for us what the blindnesses are on each side of the debate, the things that we're not, that each side is not seeing?
Yeah, so the blindness on the side of those who hold to classical liberalism was beautifully captured in a book by Michael Sandel. Now, Michael Sandel is a Jewish professor at Harvard University in the States, but he wrote a book called The Tyranny of Merit, Whatever Happened to the Common Good? And in his thesis, my law class in Harvard is full of people who all believe that they're in Harvard solely as a result of their own merit, whereas the reality is there are probably 4 or 5 times as many applicants, all of whom would be deserving of a place at Harvard, and I somehow have to pick. But the winners think that they're there solely because of their own merit, and that we have societies which fuel this idea of individual success. And classical liberalism, if we go back to figures like Mill, says, I'm entitled to live my life so long as I don't cause active harm to others. And that's understood by liberalism quite narrowly. That gives us a framework for toleration, because there are certain sorts of insult or divergence of view that don't cause harm. Those on the other side of the debate react strongly to that. But they've been swept up with constructivism, the idea that we can make and shape reality in all its aspects in whatever way we choose to. So you end up in this odd position on the other side where you'll have criticism of our society as patriarchal and of the traditional family as being authoritarian, it's just a social construct. But from people who, according to their own principles, don't believe that there is any sort of natural idea of the family. There's just different options. Well, if there are different options, why should we presume that the options, these new options for relationship that are being put forward, are any better than the traditional family? If there's a way of, you know, if it's just about what we choose, societies around the globe have overwhelmingly opted for the traditional family, but that's supposed to go out the window. But when you point out this inconsistency, you know, if you were claiming there was some objective truth about the traditional family being wrong, then you'd have a ground for making the claim that we should get rid of it. If it's just one preference amongst others, why should we go with your preferences rather than the one that's worked for years and years and years for generations across time and space?
Are there changes, do you think, in the wider culture that have led to this difference in perception and the change in the debate? What's happening in post-Christian Europe that has led us to this situation?
Well, I think anybody who knows any basic psychology will know that as human beings, we're all prone to confirmation bias. You know, naturally, once we find a particular viewpoint attractive, we try and go looking for evidence that supports our view. And we're reluctant, because it's uncomfortable, it's disturbing, to look at evidence that challenges our view. But what we now have are extremely smart methods for delivering news and the view of reality to us, built around algorithms that actually simply amplify our confirmation bias. Now, if I'm on the one side of the debate, I can go and find progressive news channels, radio shows that will take me in one direction. If I'm on the other side, there's a completely different suite I can go to. And then you have these mediating institutions, whether it's Google search or Twitter or Facebook, based on my previous likes, they will then start selecting information and news for me. So that whatever theory of society I hold to, whatever side of the debate I am, they'll start giving me a distorted, one-sided view of reality where most of the voices I hear are from people that I agree with or commentators who agree with the views I have. And if I engage and like, well, that then drives the people I'm not engaging with off my radar. So again, we get this situation. Not only do we deliberately attend to particular facets of the societies we live in and ignore others, but we're actually being fed that constantly.
So even though, ironically, even though the world's much better connected, we've got more access to information from every source than we've ever had before, knowledge is increasing, yet we're living increasingly in these silos or echo chambers with people who think just like us and so are reinforcing our own confirmation bias.
Yeah, Andrew Brooks calls it the outrage industrial complex. And he's talking there in slightly pejorative terms about these social media companies and others that are making money out of fueling our anger. But I think there are other things going on as well. There's a real rise in loneliness in our cultures. We have statistics where something like 25% of Europeans would say that they don't have any close friends, and 10% of Europeans might say that they had no friends at all. And whereas in the past we lived our lives in ways that were often geographically based, and so to some extent we might bump up against people who were thinking differently from us, you know, now I can go behind my screen and on whatever views I happen to hold, however extreme, bizarre or niche they are, I can find an online community.
That's the same.
Absolutely. Who will reinforce things. Mm. And I may never actually go into the house of my neighbor next door who sees things even slightly differently. So we're able to construct these ersatz communities, which don't actually give us deep friendships, because of course we're always watching slightly what we say, because we don't want to step out of line. Because as I mentioned, once you've picked a side, we're supposed to cheer for it with enthusiasm with the supporters of a sports club. We're not ever supposed to say, well, do you know, actually, I wonder if the other side have got some points here that we need to be listening to.
Do you think there's been any change in the readiness with which people will engage, or the ability to get involved in debate with people who have a different perspective from you in a respectful way?
I think there's been a real change in the expectations of the point of debate. So again, if we go back to the sort of classical liberal paradigm, the classical liberal hope was that through free expression of ideas and through exchange and dialogue, we'd be able to come to, at best, some sort of common ground and convergence on a solution. And at worst, as you described it earlier, a kind of live or let live consensus for a society that was broad enough and tolerant enough to encompass different viewpoints.
To agree to disagree.
Yeah, to agree to disagree. But that was based, I think, on a faith in the power of reasoned logical argument. And one of the things that happens with the turn to postmodernism is that actually the hope for reasoned solutions or reasoned agreement to disagree goes out the window. And it's replaced by a belief that what we are now talking about is a war of rhetoric. So what matters is that my vision of what society should look like is more attractive than yours, that my narrative is a better story than yours. And so when I'm engaging with you, I'm not now looking to try and find as much common ground as we can. I'm trying to tell my story more loudly. Not with a view to convincing you and your supporters, but often with a view to playing to my supporter base.
For us as Christians, are there things that we're not seeing, that we're blind to, that we need to open our eyes to, perhaps even in some of the truth that the other side is speaking? Are there things that we need to recognise our confirmation bias in and, if not capitulate on, at least reach a different view?
What
are we not seeing?
That's a really, really great question. And there are sort of three levels at which we might answer it. The first level at which to answer it is, as Christians, we have every reason to believe that there may well be things that we're not seeing. Jesus talked about the man who was trying to take the speck of dust out of the eye of his opponent and hadn't seen the log in his own eye. And that's just one example of the many times, actually, that the Bible warns about self-deception. The psalmist prays that God will reveal his hidden faults. Jeremiah and Obadiah talk about the pride of the heart and the way that our pride, our self-righteousness can deceive us. Titus, interestingly, talks about pleasure and passions as things that can deceive us about ourselves. And John, of course, says in 1 John, if we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. So I think the starting point is, as Christians, we have every reason to be suspicious when we think that we're seeing everything and there's nothing we're missing. At the kind of deeper level, then, if we acknowledge that, we then have to think about, well, how are we going to engage? And the first thing to do is to listen. One of the things that is absolutely toxic about deplatforming is the refusal to listen. And so we, I think, need to model listening to people and trying, as a result of that listening, to do the second thing, which is to discern. And to see, is there a genuine concern that is motivating this attack or this response or this program? You can see, as Tim Keller's said, in relation to one form of wokeism, critical race theory, there is a genuine concern about why it is that so many black people still end up in prison, or why the police stop so many more black people than white people. And that's true in the UK as well as in the USA. Now, the solution may be one we would want to disagree with, but we get it wrong if, when that issue is raised, we simply try and change the subject. And then I think the third thing then is that then we have to go back and think about the resources we have in the Bible for addressing areas of genuine concern.
And you want to unpack that a bit more. What resources are there for helping us to address genuine concern? So if we've listened and we've discerned, and now we're wanting to engage and speak and debate and converse, what's there to guide us in how best to do that in this changed cultural environment?
Well, one of the things actually is that we need to be people who do maintain that distinction between a person's actions and their essence. We do need to maintain that ability to, hate the sin but love the sinner. We do need to maintain that hope for change. And it was really interesting that Martin Luther King, when he was engaging in civil rights activism, was absolutely clear that however bad he thought certain racist acts were by certain white people, that did not mean that, he wasn't going to deal with them. He didn't think there was any possibility to change their minds. He talked about the need to love our enemies, and that it's only by loving our enemies and being able to distinguish between who they are and what they've done that we can begin to turn them into our friends. So I think we really have to model humility, the ability to accept our mistakes both corporately and individually, and the ability to engage in genuine dialogue. That's what's really missing in our culture, is genuine dialogue, where I listen to you and you listen to me, and we try and see if we can move forward. The hope would be that even if we can't agree, we have a better understanding of each other's position. That means we need to be examples in debate. I was taught at school you should always take your opponent's argument at its highest, not caricature it and parody it. Having said all of that, we still have to recognize that Jesus said, if they've hated me, don't be surprised if they hate you. So we can do all that and still find ourselves being misrepresented and persecuted and under attack.
So the fact that we're being misrepresented or people are hostile to us does not necessarily mean that we've done anything wrong. It's just the fact that the Word of God and the Gospel will polarize and divide people when it's properly understood.
Paul said talked about the scandal of the Gospel. And it's interesting how he does that, because he does it in relation to one of the big divides in his time, which was between Jews and Greeks. And each of them had a different discourse. One of them was looking for prophecy. One of them was looking for philosophy and wisdom. Each of them had a different set of customs. Each of them had a different view about how you should live in the world. And both of them were outraged by the Gospel. Yeah.
And Paul, of course, was the master at communicating the Gospel into different cultural and worldview contexts. What lessons do you think he might have for us today? I guess I'm asking, how can we best communicate the love of Christ and the truth of the Gospel into this new environment in which we find ourselves and to this generation who are thinking along these lines?
So Dan Strange, in his book about magnetic people, talks about subversive fulfillment, the way in which the Gospel on the one hand, kind of subverts these alternative worldviews. It exposes them as inadequate. It shows up where they've gone wrong. It identifies where actually they're not promoting human flourishing. They're running against it. But at the same time, where those worldviews have got hold of some genuine concern, something that is missing in our current arrangements that needs to some longing that isn't there, how the gospel fulfills that longing, whether it's the longing for equality, whether it's the longing for community, whether it's the longing for intergenerational fairness, whether it's the longing to be understood and unconditionally loved, all of those things are offered in the gospel. And so I guess I would start by listening to whoever I was talking to and try to identify what it was that they're really looking for, and then begin to show how the gospel provides an answer to that. But as we know, it is the Holy Spirit who convicts. And so as Jesus found, he set out his claims, and sometimes the crowds were with him, and then sometimes the crowds walked away.
And we should expect that.
Yeah, I think yeah. So. I mean, I think we'd be much, much more comfortable if we had a formula and we could say, right, provided I follow these six steps in presenting the claims of the gospel, then everybody would be on side. But that's not what Jesus experienced. It's not what the apostles experienced. And both of them pointed back to the prophets. And so that's not what the prophets experienced either.
Are you seeing hope in this context of being able to communicate the gospel of people from these worldview backgrounds actually coming to Christ?
Yes, I am hopeful. I'm always hopeful. We live in God's world, and living as we do in God's world, there are, however distorted an account of it you give, there still have to be some points of connection to reality. They may feel a little more distant in our current culture than before, but there's always some way you can start. You know, Paul started pretty much from ground zero in Athens, where he went, well, you've got an altar to an unknown God. And off the back of that, you guys haven't got a clue, but I can still speak into that culture. I can still find a way of saying things.
It's a great challenge. David McElroy, thank you very much for your time and for unpacking this challenging issue for us.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.